downright in this beautiful country, Santa Maria, San Luis Obispo, Atascadero, this whole area. And I'm most grateful to this whole country because Willie's so right. My home in the United States is without question, you know, the Santa Maria, San Luis Obispo area. And I shall never forget it as long as I live. I've had 17 beautiful years in USA now and became a citizen in the San Luis Obispo courthouse in 1965. And here I am back home. You know, I heard a young woman speak in the marathon the other day when we first came in, and she was quoting Chuck C to the effect that after he met her, he remarked to her, "It's all right, you're home." So I am home, you know, humanly, physically, and personally in AA in this area. Last March, I was privileged to be in the New York area to do some talking, and I met some English and Irish doctors that were just out. Some of them knew in AA, some of them had been there before. We had a wonderful conference, and there was a young doctor there who shared a very serious scientific discovery with us all. He said that he had learned why alcohol was invented. And he told us that alcohol was invented to keep the Irish from conquering the world. Now, about this miracle of AA, it certainly has done a wonderful job of keeping the Irish in line and free without too much trouble. But the two miracles I'd like to report to you at the outset of my talk, these miracles happened in November of 1948 in the little province of New Brunswick, Canada, where I grew up as a youngster. And these two miracles were that Harry Truman was elected the President of the United States and Dave Stewart stopped drinking. November the 10th, 1948. When I first came in, you know, I shared with many AAs the feeling that in this first step, we had been pretty bad boys and girls, cutting up, drinking too much, getting into trouble, great tragedies, hardships, loose behavior, and so on. And here we are, sort of the worst of men and women, in abject surrender, and powerless and helpless, and what a terrible thing. Now, in recent years, I look upon step one as an occasion to rejoice, you know, to be liberated as we were by step one, to be free of all control, and to learn the joy of what it is to believe and accept the fact that your life is unmanageable. It's beautiful, you know. We are brought up in a culture where control has been stressed so much it comes out our ears. Get on top of this, get on top of that, beat it, fight it, whatever you do, you know, conquer it. And hear this beautiful message in step one, said that's not where it is at all, really. The freedom and joy and adventure of life is in giving up control, not just of booze, but of everything. You know? Powerless over alcohol, life unmanageable. Another thing you stop to think, you know, anything you try to control always divides the situation into the thing that you're trying to control and yourself. There's a split. Always in the use of control, there's an awareness of splitting something up, living a split-up life, divided life. Step one brings us all back together again. Okay, I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable, I collapse perhaps, you know, in a heap on the floor, but helpless, powerless though I may be, I've got it together for the first time in I don't know how many years that I've been fighting this booze. So the wonderful liberating effect of step one is what I'm sharing lately with fellow alcoholics. Not a thing for regret and remorse and pity and terrible defeatism, but an occasion of joy, you know, great joy and freedom of this fellowship. I was struck last night by Shorty's stress throughout that magnificent talk. My God, it's hard to put a fellow in the end of a program like this and follow all those great speakers. But Shorty made a strong point with me of, again, old things that we hear, and it's new lights get thrown on them as we keep hearing them. He spoke about the day at a time and about how these men kept saying to him, Can you stay sober, you know, for 24 hours? Can you stay away from a drink for 24 hours? And this is a great thing in our fellowship. You see, we don't attempt to tell anyone how to treat alcoholism or how to control or break your habit. We don't do this at all. We simply say to a newcomer, can you stay dry for 24 hours? And that's what we do. We stay dry a day at a time. A friend of mine last night, just for the hell of it, after we left the meeting, she's a good accountant, and she thought she'd make a little study of my sobriety length, and she comes out with something like 10,409 hours, or pardon me, 10,409 days, and then I've forgotten how many, you know, more thousand hours that comes to, but 28 and a half years comes to about that, sober. And all of this is done a day at a time. You see, I stand here wired. I am an alcoholic. I respect my fellow alcoholics who like to say they're recovered and dry and abstinent and real and all these beautiful adjectives. I'm satisfied with the plain truth. And I hope that will please my friend Willie to get a little plain truth, because, dear heart, she's a great friend, but she's always had the honesty to say to me that she always never was quite sure what I was talking about. But all I'm saying here now today is I am an alcoholic. And that means that I could be in trouble with one shot of gin. That's all I would need, no more, to start me. I'm wired for booze, and that applies to any addictive substance, too, into the bargain. I'm not recovered, and I'm not recovering. Why? Because, you see, if I were recovering, I might be able to handle a few shots. But I'm not recovering. I am alcoholic. But I'm not drinking. I'm alcoholic, and I love this beautiful contradiction. I am alcoholic and sober at the same time. Beautiful, kind of a skitsy thing to live with. Sober and alcoholic at the same time. And it's a 24-hour deal, and I'm not breaking the habit. On the outside, you know, in my work, I run into all kinds of current fashions and therapy and so on. And they're modifying habits, and they're breaking this and that, and, you know, confronting you with, you know, where you are and what a hell of a thing is and change. And I say, you know, now in my 28 and a half years sober, like Willie so well quoted, leave it alone. James Thurber wrote one of the nicest little things I ever read in my life called, leave the mind alone. Just leave the mind alone. This wonderful program of AA teaches us principally to accept. Just accept what you feel and see and hear and get rid of your fear. Just accept it and leave it alone. Accept it. We can think and feel about it, though, and that's a lot of fun, and that's what makes up our fellowship. You see, I'm still alcoholic, and I think you are, too. You must speak for yourself, because that's why we keep coming to these damn meetings, you see. We need these meetings in order to cope with a condition that is still there. I like to say, too, you know, to new people who are afraid they must make violent changes in their lives, I like to say to them and share with them this view that I stopped drinking for the same good reason I started, and that's to feel good. It's just that simple. The very same reason. I feel good here today. I used to feel good in the early balmy days of drinking. Of course, you know the old story, we got sick and into a lot of trouble. But I used to feel good. Oh, I used to feel so good. Reminds me of the Salvation Army Major's story. He went to the picnic, the army picnic, and someone spiked a lemonade, and he comes back to the Citadel, and he's acting very bright and happy and chuckling, and the young Louie is quite disturbed about this, the young woman Louie, and she says, "Why, Major," she said, "you know, you're usually so serious and dignified." She says, "This is terrible. You know, the general is going to visit this afternoon." "Oh," he says, "that's all right." He says, "I just feel so good. I feel so good I could put my foot right through the goddamn drum." The feeling good, you know, I've learned not to look at this with a lot of moral uptightness. There was something about booze that I loved that I went after. I was saying to a friend the other day, I don't know when I ever loved anything quite so much as I loved booze. Any form. I was not among the alcoholics, you know, who had to hold their nose to drink. I had a very common taste. Cheap wine, good burgundy, didn't matter what, you know, so long as it was booze with alcohol in it. I loved it. It was the great love affair of my life for about 6 or 7 years. And so I never forget that, is, you know, the kind of investment that people like you and me have put into this whole drinking pattern. There's got to be something more to it than just getting sick. you know. Certainly we got sick, but there was a hell of a lot of golden days there scattered around early in the game somewhere for many of us. I never forget this. I don't let it overcome me because I also will never forget how sick and despairing and down I had been also. So the two things must go together. So anyway, then you see my view that I stopped drinking for the same good reason I started, you know, to be myself and relax and feel good. Now, my big mistake, if anyone were to ask me, what was the biggest mistake you think you made in the years that you were fighting alcohol? And I would say the biggest single mistake was the fighting and the use of willpower. And by contrast, AA has taught me to accept, accept, accept. There are five things I like to share with you that we need to accept, I believe, in our program of AA. Five things to accept. One, accept the fact that you and I cannot drink booze in any form, for any reason, or take any addictive pill for the same reason. I cannot blame you for anything in my life if I'm smart. I should not blame you for anything. And I cannot expect anything of you. Hope, maybe, yes. Hope eternal, but expectation, no, because expectation is bitterly disappointing when it doesn't come off. Expect nothing, blame no one, and do not withdraw into yourself. Those three last dry addictions, I call them. The blaming, controlling, and withdrawing. We add those three dry addictions to the two regular addictions like drinking and pills, and we have five things, very simply, we can remember to not practice, if possible. Now, we're not going to be able not to practice the blaming, controlling, and withdrawing because these concern our feelings, you see. And I could stop drinking, but I've learned through my wonderful years of ups and downs in sobriety that I can't stop feeling. So I can put, and did put, the drugs and pills aside and booze, but I cannot get rid of my feelings, and I shouldn't because I'm a human being who does feel. And so, therefore, you know, we have to do a lot of accepting in goodwill and compassion of our own defects and weaknesses because we're going to have to be dealing with one another and with ourselves. And so the feelings, too, must be accepted, even if they're rough, but coped with and disciplined in the fellowship. All these different theories, you know, that we have about alcoholism, AA has so beautifully just, you know, gone beyond them all to a plan of action. Shorty put that beautifully last night when he said, you know, there are so many more important things for me to learn in AA than just learn a lot of these series. That's so true. And God, I ought to know because I've spent a lot of years in that area too. That reminds me of a friend of mine in Denver, Dr. Ed. He said about theories of alcoholism, he said there's this one about he only drinks to calm his nerves, his steadiness to improve. Last night he got so steady he couldn't even move. Now, with me, what did it used to be like? Well, as I've just sketched, in the early years from the age of 17 to 24, I was what I like to call a booze artist. I still get a kick. You know, we AAs can sit and talk booze by the hour, the old stories. I still like to talk about some of the dodges and angles and cons that I pulled in those early years, 17 to 24, when I was enjoying alcohol and protecting my need for it. 17 to 24, about 7 years. I just want to give you a couple of incidents in order to qualify with you. After this time, the clouds began to gather because at the age of 24, I lost my anonymity as a carefree amateur drinker. Lost my anonymity. It was on a trip to Europe, June 30th, 1934. And I went aboard with a friend of mine, sailed out of our own little port. The town we lived in was an ocean-going small port, and took off with him drunk on the morning of June 30th, 34. And it was a great trip. This is not among the events that I deplore in my drinking career. I often say to youngsters yet, you know, who are going on excursions of different kinds, I tell them about this fantastic trip, $1 a day. There's 11 days crossing, 14 coming back, a return trip to Europe for $25. Good food on board these beautiful Norwegian trampers, only one thing. The captain on the way over, a Norwegian captain, Markussen, was an abstemious Lutheran. He's the only sea captain I ever met in my life, and I've met several, being brought up in an ocean-going area. He was the only sea captain I ever met who had scruples about selling booze at sea. And here we are out a couple of days, and the captain would not sell us any booze. And so he finally said, out of his kindness of his heart, he said, "It's a holiday in your country today, July 1st. He said, "I will give you a little present." So he gave Mac and me the measliest little bottle of claret I ever saw in my life, with dust all over it, and we just passed it one to another, and one swallow each, we knocked off the 6-8 ounces of claret. We were sober the whole time that trip. We got disgustingly healthy, the sun, wind in the North Atlantic, and there was only one thing on shipboard to read, and it was the New Testament in French. I was brought up in French Canada, so I knew some French, not as much as I should have, but I knew some, and so, you know, to pass some of the quiet hours, I got reading the New Testament in French, and I came across that passage that baffled me. I discussed it with Mac. I said, "The world doesn't live at all like this anymore. I don't even remember being told about it in Sunday school." And it was the simple little sentence, the strongest, most powerful sentence yet in my life and all my work and meaning, and those three words were, "Resist not evil." Resist not evil. And it means exactly what it says. It means don't fight evil. That's what it means. And yet, look all through the ages how much, you know, we have violated that tremendous insight. And I don't know why it struck me. I guess it was the contradictory nature of the lesson compared to the world we were living in at that time, at the very heart of a depression, and the whole business. And I just tucked it away in the back of my mind because I thought it was kind of almost idiotic kind of advice, you know, to apply to the present world. But you'll see how it came, you know, through the years to make its application in life for me in this program. Because I think if there's one thing more than anything else that AA is saying to us, it's resist not evil. Don't fight it. Whatever the hell it is, accept it, you know. You know, back in Palm Springs, there's a group of us in the afternoon meeting. We talk about, you know, how much people can get away with. But one thing, a fellow might come in and say, "Gee, I just had an accident. I ran down a dog at the corner. I smashed a car in the next street. It's completely in complete ruins. And I lost my job. Things are in a hell of a mess. I might even be up for manslaughter. I think I might have struck somebody. I'm not sure." And everyone says, "Yeah, yeah. Did you take a drink?" Everything else is all right, but did you take a drink? The whole point being, you know, the acceptance of what we can't change, acceptance all through. Resist not evil. Anyway, that was the first note of qualification in this fellowship, because while it was a trip that I don't yet regret, it was a kind of a trip that I guess a normal, intelligent, well-adjusted person doesn't do, take off without any money, and depression years, and all the rest of it. There was everything about it that didn't seem right. And when I returned from that, I'd become a marked man. Davy Stewart, you know, ran away to England drunk and so on. Now you see the whispers are all around. My anonymity is shot all to hell. I've gotten away with being a social kind of partying drinker up to this point, but now I'm a marked man. I'm a problem drinker. And I returned to the university in the fall, and the director of my studies said, "He said, I understand, he said, you had a rather exciting trip to Europe this summer. Rather wet, wasn't it?" And then this thing started to gather momentum. And then, to make a long story short, I wound up in the Royal Canadian Air Force, and the drinking by this time was so bad. I was an officer, and it got so bad that I was threatened with three ways to go. I was told by the adjutant that I could select court-martial, be retired, or resign. Now, he said, "I don't think you'll make it in the court-martial, Dave. I don't know if you can stay sober long enough to defend yourself." And then, you know, he said, "Retirement at your age, how would you feel out in the street as a retired officer at the age of 32 or 33? I said, "Not too good." He said, "You know, you can resign and probably save face." So I resigned my commission, and one has to give a reason. And, you know, the protocol in Canada is, you work through the king and just address to His Majesty King George VI and via, you know, the channels. And I said that I was hereby resigning my commission in His Majesty's Royal Canadian Air Force by reason of general disagreement with Air Force policy. And they saw fit to accept that excuse and prosecute the war without me. I was wondering how they'd make it, but they seemed to have come through pretty well. Then, you know, in my shame and remorse and guilt after that, I joined the army as a private in the infantry. It's a very different story from the pampered officers of the Air Force. And I went through a long business here, finally worked myself up to commission status again. But I have to tell you one story about my army experience when I was so bored with the training conditions in Camp Borden where I was. They called for volunteers one day for Italy, and I volunteered, and this called for a new medical check. Now, you look at me today, I weigh about 180 pounds, and at that time, I weighed 132. And then, as now, my eyesight's about 2400. So I knew I had to beat these two raps if I was going to make it to Italy. So the night before the medical, I slipped into the doctor's hut, and I memorized the eye chart. I said, I figured I got that chart that I'd be all right. Then I have a way of kicking back my knees so that I can drop about an inch or an inch and a half of height. So the next day I went in and took the medical, and he put me on the scale. And he said, my God, soldier, you are skinny. I said, yes, sir. He said, but you're pretty hard. You're in pretty good shape. He said, you're underweight. Yeah, it's not too bad, maybe. It's better than being overweight. So he said, now read the eye chart. And so I went, PBQST. I rhymed off all the letters right down to the small of them. Oh, he says, that's beautiful. He says, the only thing is, soldier, you memorized the wrong side of the chart. So that was the end of my overseas service. Then I was dispatched to a unit where I was doing fatigues for the Postal Corps. I was cleaning out the kitchen and the latrines and so on. And the wide spectrum of experience that alcoholics have is a wonderful thing to behold and talk about. But anyway, I came out of that, and in 16 months I had become an officer again and barely got out of the Army with an honorable discharge in August of 45, more by good luck than good management, certainly. Qualified, don't I? Then I have to tell you, though, about some other things that are important in this drinking experience of mine. I was on my last drunk was in August of 1948, and I had become a periodic by necessity. You know, I hear a lot of people talk about being daily drinkers and having binges too. Well, they were lucky, I think, from point of view of active alcoholism, because I used to have to dry up between drunks in order to get things straight and make a little money. And I didn't have just little, you know, normal hangovers with little shakes. I had this quiet, sinister sort of spasm-type reaction. I'd be lecturing to a class, and I would say, you know, in the days of Socrates and Plato, and then Aristotle, and I would go home, pack it up, get the hell out, you know. For a week, you know, I was just... My hangovers were dreadful. I say to this day that the biggest problem of the active alcoholic is not the getting drunk and sick and getting a belly full the way you want to. It's the awful hell and the pain of trying to control yourself. I think that control is the central feature of the addictive pattern, without doubt. It's hellish trying to appear sober when you need a drink and shouldn't be there at all, wherever it is. So, then... This drunk I speak of in August of 48, I was nursing up, you know. My binges took the form of you'd wake in the morning sick, but then you have to nurse the hangover. Then I felt, well, if I can get enough beer and a couple of shots down for breakfast, that'll be good, a good breakfast, because after I had a few inside, I could eat. Then that would, you know, tamp that down for the day's drinking. So I'd work up to early evening and just begin to get smashed, really smashed again. And one night, my dear wife, Hilda, was going out the door. And I looked over, and I said, where are you going? Oh, she said, I'm going to a movie. I'm going to a movie, and after that, I think my friend Audrey and I'll probably get on to the Top Hat for a dance or two and a drink. I said, you've got to be kidding. This is the first time dear Hilda had taken upon herself to do the kind of thing that the good old Al-Anons are teaching all the girls to do today. You know, just let him be and go. And so before Al-Anon was out at all, dear little Hilda sort of had a
an anticipation of really the way to operate, because she's a pretty good kid. She finally came to the place where the tears were gone and the resentment and everything, just accepting it. And she was on her way out, and I said, "You can't do this to me, you know. Here I am, the greatest man in the world, in his cups, and my wife is taking off, you know, just cavalierly, no fuss, no special fuss at all." And I was amazed. I said, "Well, Davy, my son, he's upstairs, 6 years old." I said, "He's in bed, you know." "Oh, don't you worry about Davy. He's all right." I said, "He can fall out of bed." "Oh, he's all right. He'll get back into bed. You just look after yourself, Dad. I'll be back when I'll be back." This is what I call, my friends, the, you know, what happened, the phase of what happened. This is, you know, the loss of support. Loss of support at death, you know. Your wife takes off in the middle of your binge where you think she should be still catering and fooling around and trying to please and make you comfortable. She's taking off. She doesn't care, you know. Fantastic. That had a fantastic impact. Now, this is August. It was still about three months before I was to find this fantastic fellowship. It was August. Loss of support at depth. Then on this drunk, I began to think, too, of other things. All through, the failure of my drinking, as I said earlier, can be attributed, failing of trying to cope with my drinking can be laid at the door of one basic thing, and that's control. And so I found, too, that besides this loss of support that I was undergoing through my wife, that I was losing control. I had used it, I needed it, and used it, and now I was losing it. But the thing about the loss of control is not that it's so bad when it happens. It's all the terrible pain that you go through in the use and the need of that control up to the time it breaks. And then, of course, I found, too, that the old self-sufficient thing that I used to say, "By God, I'll show them," this began to break, because I could see that I did desperately need my wife or some friends. And now my wife, you see, was withdrawing support for my pattern. And so these were grim events, but very powerfully meaningful and helpful events. The loss of support, the knowledge of the loss of control, and the knowledge of the loss of self-sufficiency. Now, if you'll bear with me for a moment, I want to talk about these three losses in a way to relate to our fellowship. That's kind of my own little thing, and I get a big kick out of it. You know, the book says more will be revealed, and I want to talk to you about this in the sense of more is revealed. You know, our fellowship started. I'm excited still about the way our fellowship started and the reasons for it. Bill Wilson and a little group went to the financiers in New York, as you know from the history, and could not get any financial help. They thought, like anybody in society, you can't do anything in America without becoming... excited still about the way our fellowship started and the reasons for it. Bill Wilson and a little group went to the financiers in New York, as you know from the history, and could not get any financial help. They thought, like anybody in society, you can't do anything in America, an unbecoming country, without a little money and support to get things going. You know, just buying literature, whatever, room to meet in. So, you know, the Rockefeller gave them a dinner, as you know from the story. And then he remarked very kindly, "I could give you some money, fellows, maybe $50,000 or so, but I don't think I will. Because you have hold of something here that I don't think money's going to..." What a wonderful insight for that old man. I don't think it was a stingy act on his kind. I think he did have tremendous insight, this old man, when he told Bill and his friends, "No, you know, no money." So, you know, step one, you know, Paulus or alcohol, life unmanageable, there's nowhere to turn. You know, the captains of commerce are turning us down. We can't get any help. But it didn't stop there. They thought, what about science now, from the point of view of getting our fellowship in shape? So they write Jung, Carl Jung, and Dr. Carl Jung writes back, and look, there's nothing known to science. There's nothing known to science that can help you fellows. Maybe some kind of spiritual experience, something of your own you make up, but nowhere in the nameable known, anonymous world is there anything that can help. So I look upon step two as the introduction to real anonymity. Come to believe in a power. We were, you know, they were strapped and struggled and desperate. No human power, no nameable authority could come to their aid. So they came to believe in a power greater than themselves, restored them to sanity. anonymous at that point. What kind of power? You don't have to nail it down yet. It's just a power greater than yourself to restore your sanity. And step three, then made a decision to turn our will over to the care of God as we understand Him. And they did this, they had to do this because whether Protestant, Catholic, Mohammedan, or whatever, the churches too had no record of ongoing success in treating alcoholics. I like to tell the story of Pat and Father Riley. And when I tell this, this could apply just as well to an Episcopalian priest or a Protestant minister. But anyway, the story runs that while we introduced the talk with the Irish, Pat went to Father Riley and he took, you know, the pledge for about the 10th time. And Father Riley says, "Now, this is the last time, Pat," he said, "if you're drunk again, I'm afraid, you know, in the light of what serious measures we've taken here, that I'm going to have to excommunicate you." So a few days later, Pat comes down the street, full as a goat, cutting a pretty wide swath, and he meets Father Riley, and he says, "Make way, Father Riley, for a good Protestant." So science, religion, commerce, no help from any of the name of our professional groups, so we had to become anonymous. I love this flavor of anonymous. I can conceal for the sake of the way the meetings introduce my last name, but I can just as easily reveal it with a clear conscience. To me, anonymity is not there, my friends, for me anymore so much. I respect. If I see you in your last name in a meeting, I'll go and I'll respect your anonymity and name, but I don't think the name anonymity now is where the big deal is anymore. I think it's in this wonderful, informal, mysterious atmosphere that you see nowhere else in the world. If you started to name it, we'd lose it, so it's got to be anonymous. And that's how this great fellowship started. It was born in anonymity out of desperation. We all turned to the powers of the world, and there was nothing there, so, you know, we had to become anonymous. The three steps I have found when you're working along the program, working with somebody, it's nice to put the three steps into line with the three traditions. Because after that step one that I told you was so joyous and such fun to take now and to remind ourselves of, we see that it's linked to tradition one. Because if I'm helpless and powerless, alone, at least I got it together. But in order to get real active freedom, I got to reach out my hand like it says in tradition one. Our common welfare comes first. So again, this is another meaning to me of anonymity. We become one of, anon, I understand, in the Greek means one of, also. So that I reach to tradition one as I'm reviewing step one all the time. And step two, coming to believe, goes with what kind of form, just general, can guide us? A loving God, tradition two says, as he may express himself in our group conscience. And then tradition three, which is the most magnificently simple thing to work with any new or old alcoholics. What, you know, the big argument is, what is alcoholism, what do we do about it? Look at tradition three. The only requirement for membership and maintenance in this fellowship is a desire to stop drinking. Doesn't matter whether you call it alcoholic or non-alcoholic or anything else, that's all you need, is the desire to stop drinking. Now, to me, the desire to stop drinking positively means what step three brings out, the desire for fellowship. Because if I'm going to maintain the desire of not wanting to drink, I'm going to be finding something in this fellowship each day that makes the fellowship more attractive than drinking. So the desire to stop drinking will wind up in loss of the desire to stop drinking because of our activity together in fellowship. It becomes a we situation. I think what I see most beautiful about AA, more than anything else I could talk about, would be the we experience. When I turn my will and life over to the care of God as I understand Him, I'm in a group with you. I must be honest, it's an honest program. I have not completely overcome the agnosticism of my early years. But instead of that word agnostic, I prefer to use the word anonymous. Because I know there's something there more powerful, greater than I am, that's keeping me and you sober. I know that with all my heart by faith. But a lot of it is mysterious and yet to be explored. It's anonymous. One of, we do it together, made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand Him. You know, you and I don't have to labor the tremendous difference that we're privileged to feel in AA, the tremendous difference between the fear, the degradation, the remorse, the loneliness, the misery of active drinking compared to the joy and the freedom, the fellowship of our sobriety. We don't have to labor that. We know that difference is there. But in good humor, I think it's often helpful, you know, along the line of accepting and not fighting, to see how many things are similar in our sobriety to what we were trying to get in drinking, what we were trying to get there. I often go over with friends the first three steps and the last, you know. Step 1, 2, and 3, and 12 in AA weren't all that hard for me to take because of the skill of recognition. I recognized in these steps that I had taken them when I drank. I remember well, give you a little of my history in step 1. In 1947, sitting in a big old leather chair in my den, study, university where I worked, and I'd reached the point in my drinking that night where the jug, Gordon's Dry, was just at my feet. And when I felt like a slug, you know, I'd have one. I'd, you know, given up the hypocritical trip to the kitchen and had the jug right with me, as all good alcoholics will have when they're into it. And then a thought hit me. A few people had been on my back the day before, and I thought, you know, my God, I see now there's nothing in between. I'd have to stop drinking to do what they want. And as soon as I said that, I felt a little a panic. So I reached down for another great swig. I will never forget that experience of that swig after I had that thought. And you know how it goes from the toes right up to the... And it's all together, you know. And I say, geez, I'll never stop drinking booze. I'll do an awful lot of things, you know, that for the people I love, I will. But my God, let them not ask me to stop drinking, you know. The experience of that unity, that sudden unity that I felt in that slug. I'll never stop drinking. So I took step 1 right there. That I was powerless over alcohol in my life unmanageable. Obviously, I took it then, drinking. Step 2, came to believe that a power greater. Many times again, that dear first wife of mine, Hilda, would stand in the doorway. She was an enabler, I suppose you would say then, but I don't like to call her bad names. To me, she was a saint, not an enabler, standing at that door with that slug in the morning that I needed when I was dry. That was the power greater than myself that would restore me to sanity. And I knew that power many times in drunks. I don't know where you are, but I knew exactly what I needed in order to be restored to sanity before I start going out of my mind, you know, listening to the cat stomping its feet in the hallway. So she was there with the power greater. And step 3, I remember well when I took it still drinking. It was again in 1947. I went to the president of the university where I worked, and I said, "Sir, I'd like your permission to cluster all my lectures around Wednesday and Thursday of the week." "Well," he says, "a very unusual request, Dave." He said, "Could you tell me why?" I said, "Yes, of course, sir." You know, alibi, right, expert there. I said, "Well, you see, I'll have the first and the last days of the week to counsel with the veterans." 1947, 90% of the students in university were veterans in our country. And oh, he was an old brigadier. And he said, "Well, that's most commendable." He says, "Why, sure, Dave. It's a little kind of a hard struggle, is it? All lectures and treatment." I said, "I can manage, sir." "Yes, I can." And I said, "You know, these poor veterans, they sure need my help, you know, in counseling with their problems." They were great drinkers. You know, these were the greatest drinkers in the world, the veterans of World War II. So, you know, here I was turning my will and life over to the care of God as I understood him, John Barleycorn, and all the needs that go with that. You know, obviously, I had taken step 3. I was doing what Oscar Wilde once said so beautifully, that if you're going to be a really professional drinker, you know, work is the curse of the drinking classes. And damn it, all that's so true. So, you know, I could put all my work in the middle of the week and have the rest of the time to serve my God, you know, at that time, as I understood him. And then step 12, I remember I'd have a little windfall from income tax return, an extra $50 or $75 I didn't have to sit down with Hilda and account for in some way for the family needs, and I would have this extra money, walk into a bar, and I'd say, "Oh, Janie and Alice and Bill and Harry, gather around old Dave. No one seems to be troubling you. Set him up, Joe." I was carrying a message to the alcoholic, to steal something. It's really amazing, you know, how much fun and instruction it can be to see that we're not into a deadly opposite way of life from the point of view of what we really want. What I really want now is the same as what I've always wanted. There are three things, for example, that I learned in drinking that I carry right into my sobriety. I carry my alcoholism right into my sobriety. Not only my inability to drink is just as clear and as definite today as it ever was, but on the personal side of life, there are three things that I learned from drinking, and I carry them right into sobriety. As I said to you, and I repeat, at the start of the whole thing, I drank, you know, to feel good. And I am sober in order to feel good. I have found now that the pattern of feeling good in AA is a much more intelligent, more exciting, more adventurous plan than the drinking thing, because the feeling good now involves me in ways of being now, more than just having money and drinks that I needed. Now it's a question of being, you know, being free and easy, being adventurous, and to be loving, you know. Forms of being are what I find now in the feeling good that wasn't, not the same ingredients in sobriety as they were in boozing, when everything was have, and fight. But anyway, the basic thing, the wanting to feel good, I carry from the drinking into the sobriety. I got a better show going now, of course. I found out, too, drinking, I found out something that was completely contradictory to everything I was taught in my university courses. Now, all the university courses of my year in psychology and sociology would teach you that the environment makes the man, you know. That you, wherever you are, you're the product of your environment. The drinking experience taught me clearly and well how phony that stuff is. Because if I was at a party and things weren't going well, all I had to do was go to the glove compartment of my car, take two good swigs, change me, and I came back and changed the entire party. Change the world by changing me. I learned that drinking, and that's exactly what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. We change our whole way of life. Why? Not by me changing you, or you trying to change me, but each of us changing himself. A little, some, or a lot. The change. We learned that lesson drinking, except we don't put booze and drugs in now. We drink in the lessons of the fellowship. And third, in drinking, I make this admission, I wanted desperately to love and be loved. Desperately. It failed miserably in the terrible aloneness of any alcoholic. Here, I have all the love I can manage, more than I can really take care of in this tremendous fellowship. And nothing in this fellowship ever lets a man down, or a woman. Now, Shorty, too, was talking about spiritual last night, and I agree so much with him. I don't see why any of us need to get hung up on what we call a spiritual angle. And I quote him again. I couldn't do better. He said, anything that is not material is spiritual. And that's so true. These three things that, you know, we were trying to satisfy with booze couldn't be satisfied with booze because we were trying to achieve a spiritual experience through a material means. The feeling good. You ever stop to think that feeling good, just drop out one O, that really feeling good is feeling God? And second, changing the world by changing me. I don't do that by any material means at all. And wanting to love and be loved, of course, does not depend on having things. So these three great things that I needed so much in drinking were spiritual aims, except the booze and drugs couldn't handle it. Now, this simple fellowship can more than do it for any of us. I'm reminded of a very simple bit of counsel that I heard a great spiritual leader say just before I came over here yesterday, the day before. Love, serve, and remember God. Let us, you and me, love and serve one another and remember and keep alive the God of our understanding. The serenity prayer is magnificent, you know. Again, the acceptance. Serenity, the serenity to accept what cannot change. For me, that means everything. Everything in this world except one thing, me. And even that little thing in me that I change, I can't do alone. I still need your help. Courage to change the things I can, I would simplify by courage to change the thing I can, and that thing is me. The wisdom to know the difference, if I'm ever in doubt, I need never go wrong in my appeal to you, that group conscience. I don't say that group conscience is always 100% right. But it doesn't matter about being right or wrong. It's a strong guide, and it can be depended on to take me through any crisis that I have. Just present it to the group conscience. Wisdom to know the difference. You, the source of my God. There's a little prayer, too. on the wall of the chapel where I worked for several years in the Detroit area. And it gives me a lot of comfort in my doubt or despair. And it's this. I sought my God, and he eluded me. I sought my soul I could not see. I found my brother and sister, and I found all three. God bless you all.